I'm Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. Today on the program, we look back to one of the country's first media-fueled murder trials. We're going to go back in time to the Chicago of the 1890s. Journalist Robert Lorzel is our guest. He joins us to talk about the disappearance of Louise Lutgard in the spring of 1897. No body was found, but her husband, Adolf, was arrested for murder. He was the owner of a large sausage factory, and the case came to light not long after the World's Columbian Exposition closed in Chicago. Lorzel describes discovering the case on the opening page of his book, Alchemy of Bones, Chicago's Lutgert Murder Case of 1897. While flipping through a scrapbook at the Palatine Historical Society one day in 1995, I came across the following article clipped from the October 23, 1897 Palatine Independent. Quote, Fred A. Smith of this place and another reporter of the Chicago Journal caused a sensation among the other Chicago dailies by reporting the actions and discussions of the Lutgert jury while in their room. It is the first time that such a thing has been accomplished during the progress of such an important trial. They obtained the news by means of the air shaft running through the room, one of them being lowered in a chair, suspended by a rope from the room above, and watched the proceedings through the air register. So, journalist Lorzel was hooked. A couple of the first questions he asked, what kind of case would send reporters into an air shaft to eavesdrop on the deliberations of a jury? How was the story reported by the city's dailies? And how had such a sensational story been forgotten? Listeners, I invite your questions about the case in the city of Chicago at the end of the 19th century for our guest. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Robert Lorzel, a University of Illinois alum, attended high school in Onarga. He's an associate editor at Pioneer Press. The press publishes newspapers in the suburbs of Chicago. His book, Alchemy of Bones, Chicago's Lutgert Murder Case of 1897, is published by the University of Illinois Press. And you can read the first chapter online at www.alchemyofbones.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Robert Lorzel, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be on.
As you point out, this was not the first trial to generate a public sensation. And you say the city of Chicago at this point had a reputation for sin and lawlessness, inspiring books with titles like Chicago, Satan's Sanctum.
Yeah. But that title is one of my favorites.
Yeah. Have you been able to put your hands on that book?
I've looked at that book, and yeah. I think it was either the Newberry Library or the Chicago yeah. Historical Society, one of these places where they have a lot of the old books that you can haul out, even though they're the kind of books that are hard to find at a bookstore.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we've got this reputation already for the city of Chicago for this place of sin and lawlessness. But at the time, the Chicago Tribune is calling this case the most remarkable murder case of a generation. Was it?
Well, readers will kind of have to judge that after they look at my book, I think. It was pretty remarkable, but there was also the element of newspaper hype. The newspapers like to use a lot of exaggeration and outlandish adjectives to describe the cases of the time. I think this case merited at least some of that hype because it was so unusual that there was a murder being charged even though a body had not been found.
Yeah. Do you have the book there with you?
I do.
Would you go to page 72 and maybe give folks an idea by reading that first paragraph of the chapter called The Sweating?
Yeah.
Share with listeners the arrest made in Chicago in 1897. Give us an idea of what was going on there on the criminal landscape.
Sure. The miscellany of arrests in Chicago in 1897 included 253 for being, quote, inmates of opium dens, unquote, 62 for prize fighting, 56 for mayhem, 55 for fast driving, 45 for rioting, 33 for violating the ordinance concerning bathing, 14 for bigamy, 10 for, quote, crimes against nature, unquote, 9 for stealing horses, 9 for abortion, 5 for illegal voting, and 4 for distributing obscene literature. The most serious crimes, however, were the 21 abductions, 17 kidnappings, 4 manslaughters, 7 attempted murders, and 33 murders.
Pretty dangerous place.
Yeah, it was obviously any big city at the time would have had a fair amount of crime, but Chicago was particularly known for being a somewhat risky, dangerous place to go. And it still managed to draw a lot of people from rural areas and other cities who were looking for a new life and an opportunity to make it big in the big city.
Yeah. What was the ordinance concerning bathing?
That's a good question. It's one of those statistics that's listed in these reports you see, and you just read that and think, what was that all about?
Well, you had to do a lot of digging, and you had to do a lot of deciphering. On the website, there's a wonderful item, Chicago Lingo of the Late 1800s, which is a lot of fun to look over. So this was quite a research project.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And the large proportion of the research I did was from the newspapers of the time. The court records are there, but they don't have a complete transcript, and so I'm somewhat forced to rely upon the newspapers. But it's fortunate that for someone today researching it, that there were 10 daily newspapers in Chicago at the time, and they covered this trial in great detail. So it's possible to go through those papers and see the transcripts that they published, as well as interviews and other stories, and piece together a story the way I did.
Yeah. Now, given the papers of the day were taken by hyperbole, was that a challenge?
Yes, it was a challenge. I had to basically make a lot of judgment calls as to what I believed and what I didn't believe in the newspaper coverage. And there are certain places where obviously it's pretty apparent that they're using hyperbole in certain places. And other things just seem, you get real skeptical if you read certain accounts that just don't seem possible. But there are a lot of places where I was able to compare how the various newspapers covered the same event, and generally you would see the same basic story. There would be some nuances, a difference between it, but I was able to try to compare the newspapers and come up with what I think is the most accurate story you can from the newspapers at the time.
Yeah. Well, give us some sense of what the population of the city was like at the end of the 19th century, 1897. This isn't long after, really, just a couple of decades after the Chicago Fire.
Yes, after the Chicago Fire, the city began rebuilding pretty rapidly, and that period from around the time of the fire up until 1900 was a period of great growth. And in particular, there were a lot of immigrants coming into the city from places like Germany and Poland and Ireland. So you had a real mix of different ethnic groups sort of learning how to get along together, some of them continuing to have their own little communities within the city. I do mention in the book, a lot of the main characters here were Germans, and on the north side of Chicago, there was almost an area where you could speak German and not know English and get along fairly well by staying within the German community there.
Yeah. And Adolf Lutgert, he was German-born. He was born in Germany in the mid-19th century.
Right.
So what else should we know about him?
Well, he had come to Chicago at the end of the 1860s, worked in a variety of odd jobs, including tanning and in the leather business, and had become a saloon keeper at one point. Gradually worked his way into becoming a sausage maker, first kind of doing a butcher business and then selling sausages door to door, and this was apparently very, very successful. And next thing you know, he had built a factory. He had then upgraded to a second factory, which is the one where the murder was alleged to have happened. And this is a booming business, but in 1893, right at the end of the World's Fair, a depression hit the country and hit Chicago as well. And a lot of people were out of work. There weren't quite as many people out there to buy his product. A lot of the vendors who owed him money couldn't pay their bills. And the next thing you know, his factory was on the decline. So by 1897, when this murder case happened, he had pretty much shut down the factory, had only a few people there working, things like a night watchman and a couple of guys doing some work. But he had fallen in financial hard times, and probably not going to be very long before he was kicked out of the factory, and he might have even lost his home. Things had kept on going at the rate they were going.
Yeah, but at one time, that was one of the biggest sausage-making concerns in the United States.
Apparently. That's right.
What a story of boom and bust. The business situation that he found himself in, did it cause a rift between Adolf and his wife?
Yes, his wife had all along been skeptical about the idea that of taking out loans to pay for his factory and other things with his business. So when he had taken out loans to do that, she was worried that the family would have this debt to pay off. And then when it turned out that, you know, he was having financial problems, she was scolding him frequently about the situation that he had gotten them into. And there's a lot of testimony about her state of mind before she disappeared. The defense was that she had run off into the night. She had decided to abandon him for some reason. And part of it might have had to do with her mental state. Part of it might have had to do with the fact that she was upset about the family losing all this money and she didn't want to be poor. Whether you believe that or not is an open question. But even if you think that Adolf Lueckert killed Louisa, there is pretty reliable evidence or testimony out there that she had been in this state of mind where she was concerned about the money that the family was losing.
And besides the housekeeper, did she tell anyone else that she was just going to leave?
Yeah, there were a number of people. Some of them were workers associated with the factory. Some of them were friends of the family. Basically, a lot of people that she had come into contact with in the weeks leading up to the up to her disappearance. The question is how much credence you put into those stories, whether these witnesses were perhaps trying to protect Adolf Lueckert by making up a story, or perhaps they were exaggerating something she had said and building it up into the story about how she had said she was going to run away.
Yeah. It seems all the witnesses have some, well, maybe not all, but many of the witnesses have some problems, and there were some of Chicago's less than finest who were paying witnesses.
Right.
Yeah. So the witness situation is, it's really hard to put this together and make up your mind.
Yeah, the subject of paying witnesses is interesting because obviously if someone is out of work or they're unemployed and the county wants them to be on the witness stand and is even paying their expenses to maybe travel to the trial and things like that, it's understandable that they would pay these witnesses some money for their expenses, but that then raises the insinuation that the defense attorneys keep bringing up of, you know, if these people are getting money from the Chicago Police Department or the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, how can we believe their testimony, mm-hmm. or are they being swayed by that?
Yeah. Okay, so Louisa is disappeared, and Mr. Lueckert, how does he react?
He sort of goes about business like nothing has happened, which is one of the main reasons I sort of think, you know, that he probably was guilty, is that his behavior during that time period right after she disappeared was awfully suspicious and often seemed like the behavior of a guilty man. He at times tried to ignore the fact that she was gone, but he was also making statements to neighbors and friends and his workers that were sort of incriminating. He was telling people not to go to the police and offering them jobs for the rest of their life and things like that. He didn't actually tell anyone that he had killed his wife and come out with an outright confession like that. But the things he was saying were raising suspicions, and he didn't go to police to report her disappearance.
Yeah.
Even though sometime earlier, when one of his Great Danes had disappeared, he had gone right to the police department to tell them his dog was missing. But then his wife disappears one morning, and he doesn't bother telling the police about it.
Yeah. Well, throughout much of this, he seems rather unflappable, and I wonder if that's because there's no body.
Well, if you assume that he actually did the crime and had disposed of the body, he may have been in the state of mind where he thought he had committed a perfect crime and gotten away with it. I think I mentioned at some point in my introduction that it's quite possible over the course of human history there have been a lot of people who have committed murder and managed to get rid of the body somehow and never been charged. It's an unknowable, you know, quantity. There hadn't been too many cases previous to this where a case like that came up and actually resulted in murder charges, and you presented a situation where the police and prosecutors had to try to prove in court that someone had committed murder, even though they didn't have a corpse there as evidence.
Hmm. Well, when did Mr. Lutgert become a suspect then?
It's hard to pinpoint the exact moment, but things started to happen when Louisa Lutgert's brother, Dietrich Bicknies, showed up and discovered she wasn't there and was quite upset about it. And he began his own personal search for her, visiting various friends and relatives to see if they had heard anything about her. And he quickly became suspicious that Adolf had committed some foul play here. So he and some of the other in-laws on Louisa's side of the family went to the police and reported her missing. And then at that point, the police began questioning Adolf Lutgert, although it was not right away that they found evidence to charge him.
Yeah. But pretty soon he was on the front page of the paper.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, in his defense, I wonder if his trying to keep it hushed up was a matter of not wanting to be in the newspapers.
He did use that explanation, and I suppose there's some credibility to that. It's the kind of thing that he probably wouldn't have wanted in the paper. But you would think he would have made more effort to find what had happened to her.
Yeah. Well, when did the investigation begin to center on the sausage factory, and was there evidence of foul play found there?
That happened when one of the workers who was still at the factory, one of them went to the police and started talking about what had happened on the night of May 1st, 1897, which was the night she disappeared. And the watchman, Frank Balk, spoke to the police about how Adolf Lutgert had been in the basement of the factory all night working around the vats. And it was not clear exactly what he was up to, but he was running steam into one of the vats where normally the vat would have been used to put the sausage in as they were smoking it and doing all that, curing it. But on this night, they're running steam in there. He had some kind of solution in the vat going. And the next morning, he had a couple of his other workers clean up the mess that was left behind. So this resulted in the police theory that he had killed his wife, put her body in this vat, and used a solution of potash to dissolve it.
Hmm.
The one thing which I find really curious, and it's a little hard to believe, is that he had his workers clean up the scene afterwards, and then 2 weeks later the police show up and they still find a bunch of fluid, they find some small bone fragments and two rings, one of which is inscribed LL on the inside, which would seem to be her initials. So that became the basis of the evidence against him, was that these bones and some of the fluid and the rings were all that remained of his wife.
Hmm. What was the reputation of the Chicago police force of the day?
Wasn't a very, very highly regarded police department. Although some of that may be in retrospect. I mean, we look back at things like the Haymarket case, which had happened in the 1880s, and it's clear that the police rounded up a lot of suspects just because of their associations with anarchists, even though there wasn't that much evidence against them. And there were a lot of other cases where the police tactics were questionable. So it doesn't seem out of the question to think that the police might have concocted or planted or exaggerated some of this evidence. It's hard to know for sure.
Yeah. Well, a couple of the men critical in the investigation, the police, Michael Scheck and Hermann Schüttler, they were, if I'm not mistaken, they were involved in the Haymarket.
Right. Michael Scheck was the sort of the lead guy in the police department handling the rounding up of the anarchists at the time of the Haymarket case. And he, in fact, wrote a book about it afterwards, which was which has been widely ridiculed for its sort of cloak and dagger stories that seem a little too hard to believe. Hermann Schüttler was more of a rank-and-file guy at that time, but he won some renown for arresting one of the anarchists in hand-to-hand combat. And by the time of the Luker case, Scheck was an inspector, sort of a special job created just for him, where he was in charge of the north side of Chicago and a lot of the investigations there, and Hermann Schüttler was a captain. Schüttler would go on later on to become the chief of police for Chicago, and he had a pretty good reputation, whereas Scheck does not have a good reputation at all, largely because of the Haymarket case. And he comes across somewhat like an early version of a Dirty Harry kind of cop who is bending the rules constantly to get the guys that he thinks are the bad guys.
Yeah. And both these guys were in the position that they were in because they were A-OK in terms of the powers that be in the city of Chicago at that time, too.
Yeah, that's right. If you read about the police in that era, they really had massive wholesale changes every time a different mayor of a different political party came in. So, you know, you get a Republican mayor coming into office, and suddenly all these Irish Democrats who were on the police force are out of a job, and all these other people, maybe, you know, sometimes it was often along ethnic lines where a bunch of German Americans would be brought in, or a bunch of people with Republican affiliations. And these two guys had managed to survive a lot of those changes, although there was a lot of controversy about Michael Scheck and whether he should be on the force.
Yeah, but industrialists and people like Colonel McCormick, they could also have some say in this matter as well.
Yeah, they probably looked kindly upon him because they remembered him as the guy who had cracked some heads back during the anarchist scare. So that kind of put him on the side of the big business people in town, and I'm sure they liked him for that reason.
Yeah. If you could go back in time and be a reporter in this day and age, Chicago in the 1890s, just for a little while, would you do it?
I think I would. I probably want a time machine to get back
back
here at some point. It was a pretty lively time, and you know, I was just flipping through a book the other day, Theodore Dreiser's memoir of being a reporter in that era, and he made a remark about how seemingly minor little episodes would get lavish treatment and be told in a lot of detail with a narrative and quotes and descriptions in the newspapers of the time, which is part of the reason why I find it so fascinating to look back at them now. It's almost, you know, it's like a time capsule or a time machine where you get a little window on moments in people's lives from 100 years ago that, you know, sometimes a little seemingly insignificant details, but they're fascinating now to see what how people spoke, the way they dressed, the way they acted.
Yeah.
During that era.
What paper or papers did the best reporting on this story?
You know, I kept changing my mind about that as I was going through it. I would find certain papers that I really liked for particular stories they were doing. I liked the Chicago Chronicle a lot, which is a paper that you don't hear all that much about, but they did some nice detailed stories. The Tribune was probably a little less sensational than some of the others, which meant that there's not quite as much detail, but I could feel it was a little bit more reliable at times. Excuse me. Chicago Daily News was a good paper. The Chicago Record was sort of the sister paper for the Daily News. Chicago Journal is the one that had the big scoop of going into the air shaft and listening in on the jury, which hooked me in the first place. And the Journal also had some fantastic illustrations in the paper. Almost comic strip like in the way they showed the same person in different poses and saying different things over the course of courtroom testimony. So that was kind of fascinating to see.
Yeah. Back to that stunt that these reporters for the Chicago Journal pulled off. In the world of the journalistic stunt, where does this one rank, you suppose?
I don't know. I'd say it's up there.
Yeah.
If for no other reason that these guys were putting their lives at danger because what they did was they snuck into the attic of the courthouse and brought this apparatus with them, you know, a bunch of rope and pulleys and a chair. And then when the jury was deliberating, they go up there and they run this rope down the heating shaft of the courthouse with a chair tied to it. And there's one of the reporters who's tied to the chair, and it's creaking as it's going down and swinging back and forth. And, you know, if it dropped, he would drop all the way down into the basement and probably die. He gets to the point where he's right next to the vent there, and so he can hear in and what the jury is saying. And he had a bit of tube, speaking tube, I think it was called, that he could whisper into. And up in the attic, there are other reporters up there holding the rope and listening to what he was saying through the tube and jotting down the quotes from the jury verbatim. And then relaying it back to the newspaper office. So this is able to hit the newsstands while the jury was still in there trying to make up their minds, and there's already stories on the newsstand about what they're saying in the room.
Yeah.
Much to the consternation of the bailiffs, who are trying to figure out, you know,
how are these
reporters getting this information?
It's really Ben Hecht stuff, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is.
Front page.
You know, the funny thing is, when the first article came out recently about my book, I received a call from Aurelia Paczynski, who was a politician in Chicago, and she mentioned that her father, an alderman, Roman Paczynski, had at one point been a newspaper reporter back in the old days, and that he had done a similar stunt. I don't know the exact details of it, but he had also gone through a heating shaft to eavesdrop on a jury. So I don't know if the Luker case was the first one where this happened or the last. It seems like it's a practice that was used at least a few times.
Yeah. I wonder what would happen to you if you did that today. I don't know that you could claim it was a clean scoop like these guys did.
Yeah. I don't know what the court might do in terms of sanctioning the reporters or declaring a mistrial or something if that happened. The result of that, though, I mean, you can question the ethics of it. But in terms of a historical record, it leaves us with actual quotes of what the jurors were saying when they were in deliberations, which is very unusual. And it was one of the things that attracted me to the case. Typically, if there is any reporting of that at all, what you get is newspaper reporters or TV reporters talking to the jurors after they've deliberated and describing in the past tense what went on in the jury room.
Yeah,
but you very rarely actually get to see what was such a close firsthand account of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I question, you know, how accurate is this? And there were descriptions of how the jurors came out after the trial, and when they were shown newspaper stories of what they had said in the case, they confirmed, you know, that it was accurate. They were kind of stunned to see that it was in there, but they, at least to the essential story of it, verify that it was accurate.
When you sit down and with buddies at the paper or with other journalists and talk about this, what do they make of it?
Today's journalists?
Yeah, of this stunt. I wonder what Pam Zekman, for example, would say about this.
You know, I haven't really sat down and talked with people about that. You know, it's this weird dichotomy, I guess, between wanting to get a scoop like that, and then questioning, you know, whether you're doing the right thing and whether you get in a tremendous amount of trouble for it.
Yeah.
If, as a reporter, you happen to eavesdrop upon something, an official saying something that was newsworthy, it'd be hard to resist using it, even if the circumstances under which you heard it might call into question whether it's usable or not.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it would also depend on how you would use it.
Right.
You know, if you would seek further information, you know, use it as a basis to ferret out other sources and other documentation, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Robert Lorzel. We're talking with him about the Lutgert murder case of 1897. Robert is the author of Alchemy of Bones, Chicago's Lutgert murder case of 1897. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk about another fascinating aspect of this case, the forensic science of the day. Wow. We've come a long way.
Yeah, forensic science was at its infancy at this time. Around the same time of the Lutgert trial, fingerprints were being used for the first time, and X-rays, which seemed like this, you know, incredible newfangled technology, and people questioned whether you could use it, those are being introduced for the first time. And in this case, they had to figure out a way of showing that these little bone fragments they found in the vat at the Lutgert factory were human bones and, you know, Mrs. Lutgert's bones. And at the time, there really hadn't been much testimony like that in previous cases. There was one previous case at Harvard University where a couple of the doctors there, one doctor was charged with killing the other, and the only human remains were a whole lot of bone fragments. And so that's kind of set a precedent for this case. This case became the first one where you had an anthropologist testifying. They brought in a couple of people from the Field Museum in Chicago, the prosecutors did, who got on the witness stand and talked about how they had looked at skeletons of humans and skeletons of animals and tried to figure out how these little bone fragments would have fit into a skeleton. And their conclusion was that these were definitely human bones and that there was no place they would fit onto a skeleton of another animal. Of course, the defense brought in its own experts who had done the same thing and arrived at a totally different conclusion. And this became it's strange because even today we hear about criminal and civil trials where jurors are perplexed about which scientific experts to believe.
Mm-hmm.
It's still fairly typical that you have battling experts on the witness stand. And in this case, it seems like the general reaction from the jurors and a lot of the people watching the case was just to throw up their hands and say, well, we don't know who to believe about it.
Yeah. Would this have been a time where scientific experts testifying in courtrooms would have been a relatively new phenomenon?
It was a fairly new phenomenon. In fact, they hadn't really set up a very good procedure for determining who could testify as an expert witness. Today, there's a whole system for how the judges do that. You have to qualify these people as experts in whatever their field is before they can give expert testimony in it. But at the time, it was kind of open door, you know, whoever they put on the witness
yeah.
stand is allowed to say whatever they want, and it's, regarded as expert testimony, even though these people may not really be experts in the field that they're talking about.
Yeah. I remember covering the opening of a trial where DNA evidence was used very early here in the state of Illinois in a trial to convict someone of, I believe it was rape. And I think the jurors were pretty hard-pressed to figure that out. And now today we take that, you know, we're more comfortable with it. But being in their shoes, you know, I wonder how they dealt with it.
I also covered a case pretty early in the days of DNA evidence. It was around 1991 or so.
Yeah.
And they really had to put on a whole show to explain to jurors what DNA evidence was. And without even talking about the specific evidence in the case, just this whole science lesson to familiarize jurors with it. I think, of course, today people have heard about it, so there may even be too much of a
too much of a reliance.
Yeah,
perhaps
people would just kind of assume that, oh, it's DNA evidence, and you know, the person must be guilty or innocent or whatever the DNA evidence says. Would probably be the natural reaction to it now. Whereas back in the early 90s, people were still getting familiar with it. I think that happened in the O.J. Simpson case too. That at the time, the whole concept was fairly new to people. So when they talked about DNA evidence there, people weren't sure whether to believe it or not.
Yeah. Well, the physical evidence was really important in this case, the Lutgert case. What became of it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I tried to find out, and all the official departments involved, the Chicago Police and the Cook County State's Attorney's Office and the clerk of the circuit court, don't know what became of the evidence in the case. It'd be really interesting to find it, because you could still potentially do some DNA testing on it today, even though the bones were in pretty bad shape at the time. A similar thing happened with the bones that they thought were part of the Tsar's family in Russia. Those had been burned, but there was enough DNA in those bones to trace back the ancestry of the people who these bones had belonged to up to the female side of the family.
Mm.
So if you could find the Lutgert bones,
mm-hmm.
The ones from the trial, and if there was enough DNA in it to do some testing, you might be able to link it to a female relative of Mrs. Lutgert or the remains of one of her daughters who had died, and perhaps connect or refute that these were her bones.
Yeah. What became of the Lutgert children?
Well, there were three children alive at the time of the trial. There was an older son from an earlier marriage, and he moved off to the West Coast, and I've never really been able to find out too much about what happened with him later on. There were two younger sons, Lewis and Elmer, who stayed in the Chicago area for a while. Lewis grew up to be a postmaster in the town of Elmhurst. Elmer became milkman, and they both seem to live pretty normal or even successful lives once the stigma of this case was gone.
It seemed that the public had a spot in their hearts, though, for those kids.
Yeah, a lot of the newspaper coverage describes them in a pretty sympathetic light, and you had to feel it's like whatever you believed had happened with the murder, you had to feel sorry for this boy who's being called onto the witness stand to talk about the last time he saw his mother alive, and knowing that what he says might or might not affect whether or not his dad is found guilty of murder. He could have been hanged for it. So if you can imagine the kind of pressure that would have been on a boy in a situation like that, it was hard not to feel sympathy for him.
Yeah. When and how did this story become a national story?
It seemed to build over the course of 1897 as the case went to trial. It's hard. It's an interesting question why certain cases get national publicity and others don't. It still happens today. You wonder about, like the Lacey Peterson case. Why is that such a big deal? And I'm sure there are several other murder cases going on right now that are equally interesting, but people don't know about them outside of the immediate area where they happen. In the Lutgert case, I don't know. I think it was just a combination of factors, the fact that there was no body found, the fact that it happened in a sausage factory, which led to this sort of urban legend that, Adolf Lutgert had ground up his wife into sausage, which turned off a lot of people from eating sausage for a while. And, he was never accused of doing that formally, but that was the way people retold the story or the joke that got told about it. So that kind of gave it a gruesome aspect. There's the fact that, it happened in Chicago. Everyone had this idea that Chicago was a pretty nasty place with a lot of crime, so they were interested in reading about what was going on in the Windy City. And then I think it just kind of built from there. It sort of snowballed, and papers in places like New York and St. Louis and in Wisconsin were running stories about it, and I found editorials from literally all over the country, as far as Los Angeles and Buffalo and Boston, where newspapers were weighing in on what they thought about the verdicts or what they thought about the way the press was covering the case, or they were criticizing all the women who were showing up during the day to attend the trial, and some of them were asking for Adolf Lukert's hand in marriage. They seemed to be fascinated by this supposed murderer.
Yeah, well, that still happens today. There's a that sort of, I can't describe it, but
yeah, it's a weird fascination.
Yeah. You don't know, weird fascination for the felon.
Yeah,
yeah. Also, that reminds me that in this case, also there, it seems to me we're on the cusp of matters psychological being introduced into a court of law.
Yeah, there had been previous cases where the insanity defense had been used before that. In this case, it wasn't an insanity defense, but the defense wanted to introduce a lot of evidence that Louisa Lukert had been crazy.
Yeah.
Or insane. I guess I should use a more politically correct term. And they claimed that the insanity ran in her family, and that she had at least one, maybe a couple of brothers who had run off and been in insane asylums, and there was a history of disappearances within her family, so that was all the more reason to believe that she had been crazy and she had run off into the night, and that Adolf had nothing to do with it. Most of that evidence, the judges didn't really allow that to be used. Some of it ended up in the newspaper coverage of the time. And how much credence you put into all that is really open to question. But it does kind of present an interesting window onto the way people viewed these issues back at the time.
Yeah. Also at this time, not long before the Lukert case, there had been the trial of an infamous Chicagoan, Herman Mudgett, also known as Dr. Henry Holmes.
Right.
And one thinks that, I think that the revelations about him must have affected how Chicagoans and the rest of the country reacted to this story.
To the Lukert case?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't find too many articles at the time that talked about both of the cases in the same breath, but I think it's natural to believe that people were thinking of it, because one of the things that Mudgett or Holmes was accused of doing was of dissolving bodies in this house of horrors that he had built on the south side of Chicago, where he had vets and he had chutes that allowed him to send bodies from higher up in the building down into the basement and things like that. And it was never really, he was convicted of a murder in mm-hmm. Philadelphia, but he was never convicted of all his other supposed crimes. So exactly what he did with all the other people who disappeared and how many murders he committed and what he did with the bodies is open to a lot of speculation. But there was this general belief that he had done things like that, which makes you even wonder if it might have given Adolf Lukert an idea for how to dispose of the body in his situation.
Mm. Wow. We have to wrap up here, but I want to let listeners know that there are a lot of twists and turns in this story that we haven't revealed. So I would encourage folks to check out Alchemy of Bones, because it's really a fascinating story, very fascinating story. Robert Lorzel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Journalist Robert Lorzel is the author of Alchemy of Bones, Chicago's Lukert Murder Case of 1897. You can go online and find more information about the book and read the first chapter and discover some of the Chicago lingos of the late 1800s at www.alchemyofbones.com. The book, by the way, published by the University of Illinois Press.